This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
In some international headlines for you, Indonesian President Joko Widodo unveiled his full cabinet on Wednesday. We spoke about this earlier in the week when the news broke that Gojek founder Nadiem Makarim resigned from his post to join Jokowi's administration.
Well, so the former Gojek founder, or still is, but currently in politics, he's now been appointed as Minister for Education and Culture. So that's interesting, I guess, in terms of getting the young Indonesians to be dot-com entrepreneurs. But he's not the only stand out in the lineup. He's also Jokowi, appointed his erstwhile rival Prabowo Subianto as defence minister, and this makes me recall that very, very nice line: "Keep your friends closer and your enemies even closer."
Indeed. So for some insight into this morning, we turn to Enrico Tanuwijaya, economist at UOB Group in Jakarta, for his take on the cabinet lineup. Thank you for joining us, Enrico. So what is the biggest surprise for you in this cabinet announcement?
I think that's a straightforward answer. The opposition becomes the cabinet member would be the one biggest surprise, but I guess it is in the full right of the president to do that. But I guess so far, if you look at the financial market reaction, it's pretty much quite ignorant about that. So I think all in all, the surprise is not impacting in any sense.
But what does this say about President Jokowi's priorities for the second term?
It's actually pretty clear. The umbrella is pretty much set out as an economic transformation, starting with both the quick reform and hopefully a continuous one in a soft and hard infrastructure. It starts by revamping the human capital quality, and then, reforming the curriculum to fit in with the current world standard. And then, of course, the continuation of the incomplete infrastructure development, I guess that will continue. And then the second point that you need to know that is actually the reform in the bureaucracy itself. So basically, this is in terms of, reducing the lag time for investment approvals and then lowering down the negative investment list and then adjusting the rigidity in the labor market, or in other words, you make the labor market more flexible, and that in itself will make the business cost to be more sensible. So I guess all in the umbrella of transforming the economic sector to basically increase the welfare of the country.
There are a number of businessmen in Jokowi's cabinet, most notably the Gojek founder, Nadiem Makarim. What do you make of the fact that he's the education minister?
Well, I think in general, I guess the president already alluded before that it will be a mixture of professionals and the political elites. Plus, there will be a number of new ministers, young for that matter. So I guess it is also less of a surprise that he will pick somebody from the millennial generation. Of course, the successful ones. But time will tell about the revolution or rather the things that he will deliver on the changes in the education reform. Given the background and then the ongoing or rather the future of the digital economy, that could be one natural choice.
Thank you very much, Enrico. And that was Enrico Tanuwijaya, economist at UOB Group in Jakarta. And now for an additional perspective on the direction of President Jokowi's administration, we have on the line with us Aaron Connolly, research fellow at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in Singapore. Thank you for joining us, Aaron. Now, while the financial markets may have been unfazed by the controversial appointments in Jokowi's cabinet, are other observers or stakeholders surprised by the new lineup? What's your take on this?
Yeah, I don't think the financial market portfolio investors in particular really understand Indonesian politics. This is a pretty extraordinary maneuver by Jokowi to try and get support for his second term agenda, which is not a particularly remarkable agenda. It's not a particularly ambitious agenda, but it's one that apparently he feels is part of his legacy. But it's a huge risk to take. Prabowo Subianto was dismissed from the military in 1998 for kidnapping student activists, for exceeding his authority. He says he returned all the activists that he kidnapped, but 13 who he stands accused of kidnapping did not return. And he's been seeking the presidency for the last 15 years. He built an entire political party around himself and his populist rhetoric. And I just don't think that two tigers can live on the same mountain for very long. It's going to be a very tense relationship between Jokowi and Prabowo, and both will be constantly concerned that the other is seeking to undermine him. And it may not last for that long.
And Aaron, do you see any political pushback towards President Jokowi's cabinet then, actually?
There's been some pushback. A number of Indonesians have been expressing dismay online, particularly at the fact that he reappointed both the Minister for Forestry and the Environment, Siti Nurbaya Bakar, who, of course, was criticized for her handling of the fires in the Haiti earlier this year. And then also the Law and Human Rights Minister during the last five-year period, Yasona Laoli, who was responsible for the administration's agreement with the revisions to the criminal code, which had a number of rather illiberal measures that were unpopular with young Indonesians. It very clearly sent the message that Jokowi was not really concerned at all about the student protests that rocked Jakarta and other cities at the end of last month.
Yeah, that's going to be an issue because unlike the first time he was appointed, there will be no parade to mark his second term. That protest you talked about was actually to laws to curtail anti-corruption, the Anti-Corruption Commission. What kind of challenge do you think that's going to pose to Jokowi going forward?
Yeah, it had several causes. One was the proposed revisions to the criminal code. Another was the revisions to the Corruption Eradication Commission's removing or damaging the KPK's independence. And Jokowi has said on a number of occasions, it's not a popular thing to say, but he's been fairly open about the fact that he believes anti-corruption efforts hinder economic development, hinder his agenda, and that he wants to see a sort of lighter touch from the Corruption Eradication Commission. A number of economists, including one who was a candidate to be finance minister, Hati Basri, wrote a letter to Jokowi earlier this week urging him to reverse course on that, arguing that anti-corruption efforts actually promote development. But I would expect to see less of that in Jokowi's second term.
Well, thank you very much, Aaron. And that was Aaron Connolly, a research fellow at the International Institute for Strategic Studies in Singapore. So a lot of eyes on the Indonesian cabinet right now, and not least because of Nadiem Makarim, who's at 35, is the youngest minister in cabinet right now. It's an interesting setup because of the 38 cabinet officials, apparently now more than about half of them are from actually professional backgrounds rather than political ones. So just showcasing Jokowi's kind of break from the norm here.
What surprised me was Nadiem being appointed to education and, you know, to the education ministry, because I thought he would be doing something more related to economy or technology. I mean, does he have the experience to perhaps roll out Indonesia's next education policy?
Well, that's the thing. He might be the figurehead, right? Because you might have the technocrats and the technical expertise sitting below him in the structure, but he's the face of education and culture. And that might, I think the intention is obviously to prompt some kind of like momentum there.
And maybe move the country's education more towards what? Technology, yeah, disruption, innovation.
I mean, he's a Harvard Business School guy. Right? He was an alumni with Anthony Tan of Grab, right? So they're buddies and it was obviously the right vintage.
He was also the co-founder of Zalora Indonesia. As an aside, so he has said before that the strength that he's going to be bringing to this portfolio is this spirit of innovation. But other analysts looking into it are saying that maybe he may actually find it difficult to deal with the bureaucracy that comes with government service because he's coming from a startup background, right?
Yeah, where everything is go, go, go and do now, right? I mean, there's no like layers of authority that you have to go and find, right?
But the other interesting thing is, and it harkens back to what you said, Chuang, which was that human rights activists looking at this cabinet appointments, some of them are slightly alarmed because there are two other portfolios which haven't really seen that much attention, specifically the religion and the home affairs portfolio, because the religion portfolio portfolio was actually given to a retired general, and the home affairs portfolio also went to Mr. Tito Carnavian, who was until recently the country's police chief. So there have been some concerns over how these men with military and police backgrounds will actually handle such sensitive portfolios, because Indonesia has seen a lot of religious sensibilities, religious sensitivities as well in the past few years.
Yeah, there's also some relation to Prabowo Subianto's, I think, cozying up to political hardliners with the far-right Islamists. Mm-hmm. And there's some concern there, not only just in terms of human rights abuses that have been left at the door, but also in terms of the spectre of political Islam coming to Indonesia.
So does this signal a new, more conservative Indonesia than in the past then?
I think people were already saying a few years ago that Indonesia was taking much more of a slant towards conservatism, especially after Basuki Cahayapurnama, Ahok, the governor of Jakarta, was charged with apostasy.
Yes.
Yeah, for insulting Islam, because that
and
was
jailed.
And jailed, because that was seen as almost very alarming and quite a win in terms of for the hardliners in the state, because before that Ahok was also considered quite close to Jokowi.
So yeah. On one hand, you want to liberalize the economy, but mm-hmm. yet on the other hand, you seem to be a little bit more
tightening the screws.
Yeah. Yeah. So how do you manage this balance then? Because normally it goes hand in hand, right? You're liberalizing everything at one go rather than going one step forward and then two steps back.
I think one step is cake and eat it as well, because I think he's trying to appease obviously mm-hmm. a vast swath of the population that like and kind of line to this. It's not just the anti-corruption laws. He's also proposed changes to the criminal code to criminalize cohabitation and sex before marriage. I mean, obviously, not to say that it's been condoned, but obviously the students in Indonesia don't like it, that they're young, right? They want to be young, wild and free, and they can't. It's tough.
Yeah, I think Jokowi also was, just before, during his campaign period, he also went on the Hajj. And that was seen as him trying to kind of ramp up his currency in that area with those who would prefer a more religious candidate with more religious, with more policies in line with Islam, which was why Prabowo was one of the ones who was very popular initially.
Yeah, some mirror, some similarities, but let's just say, between ourselves and them and us, right, in Malaysia, in terms of political alignments and what all show and tell, basically, right?
Politics isn't very different around the world, John.
No, it's not. It's not at all.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.